I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, you're very welcome along to this week's edition of the group chat. Richard, Gavin and Zara all here today. How are you doing, guys?
Good, very good.
Not too bad, not too bad. Jumping straight into it, we start in Gaza because I think the world is once again forced to reckon with images of absolute horror. The news during the week of the killing of 7 aid workers killed in an IDF airstrikes. Three airstrikes actually as part of a one hit effectively, which Israel says was accidental and says it is a tragedy. Those dead include three British nationals, an Australian, a Polish citizen, a US-Canadian dual citizen and a Palestinian driver. There's been so many instances of horror throughout this war. It's interesting and it also makes you sort of reckon, why did this one get so much attention?
I think it's probably because this is an attack on the help that's coming to help people who are at their most vulnerable. And I think the reality is that a lot of charities and aid organisations are now having to question whether or not they're taking a major risk by sending their people in to Gaza. And, you know, it's people who are doing their very best to be at the forefront to help people in their deepest hour of need who are under attack now. And, you know, I know the IDF came out and offered their condolences to the family, which, you know, in so many ways really just falls on, it's just not good enough, really.
Yeah, it falls very hollow. And one thing which I think, I haven't heard it remarked much, but I think is quite telling about all of this. So, you know, it was very important that you mentioned in the outset, Richard, that this wasn't just one strike, that it was three strikes on a convoy of vehicles. Because if it were one missile takes out that number of people, you can tenably argue that it was a misfire or some kind of miscalculation. When it's three targeted ones on a convoy which had already coordinated its whereabouts with the IDF and had the roof markings to illustrate that they were on humanitarian work, that they weren't, you know, under any kind of a false flag or whatever. For Israel to acknowledge that this was then some kind of error or mishap on their part, that it was, as they say, unintended. At the very least, if you take their explanation that it's unintended, it doesn't speak very highly of Israel's military capability or its you know, the surgical nature of everything else that it's been doing up till now. Because if they are capable of some sort of misunderstanding whereby they fire in a convoy of humanitarian vehicles and kill seven people, all of whom were involved in humanitarian work, then aren't they opening the door to acknowledging that some of the other tens of thousands of civilians that were killed, who apparently up until now were all mere collateral damage in the pursuit of Hamas, might well have been equally targeted in some kind of miscommunication or misfire, or at least some kind of human mishap, if not a deliberate targeting. And I think it's a real Pandora's box, but they've opened now by admitting this.
I don't even think it is, but I don't think that it is, because they've already admitted and have talked openly about how they've conducted military operations, quote unquote, on all of Gaza's hospitals, effectively, including Al-Shifa, most notably over the period of the last 2 weeks, which has now been razed to the ground. I'm sure a lot of people will have seen this. Effectively, Gaza's largest hospital is completely out of service now, and hundreds of people have been killed. The World Health Organization says civilians are amongst the dead. Israel's like, no, we just got terrorists. It's very hard to continually say, well, we had a mistaken identity case in terms of the people who work for World Central Kitchen, which is the aid organization whose workers were killed in this strikes. Mistaken identity is what Israel said there, but that they'll conduct their own investigation. Now, it's very hard for anybody to have any faith in that, I think, as you're alluding to as well, Anzara, because this has happened multiple times before where, and these aren't the first aid workers who have died in this conflict. There's aid workers who work for UNRWA, for work for other organisations who are consistently in Gaza who have been killed. It's just that they're Palestinians. But this has happened. There's been strikes in hospitals. There's been strikes on journalists before. And the IDF says, we're going to investigate it. But they have proven through their history and recent history as well that they obfuscate, that they obscure, and that they openly mislead in terms of these investigations. It's very hard for anybody to have any faith in these investigations. Why would you?
It was interesting to hear there was a spokesperson for Israel on Channel 4 News last night, and they were sort of trying to use the example of UNRWA and what had happened with UNRWA as a justification for, maybe not justification, but as an explanation as to why there might be some level of scepticism around, you know, aid convoys and charities and things. And, you know, it just seems like a totally poor excuse to say, oh, you know, because of what happened with UNRWA, you know, we're going to be skeptical of all aid agencies. It's just not an acceptable response.
And even still, that presumes that what they claim to have happened involving UNRWA did actually happen. I'm not saying it did or it didn't. It's not up to me to sort of justify whether it did or not, or to adjudicate on that. But that's still a matter of live contention. And there was a definite widespread view that when the allegations surrounding UNRWA emerged, or at least a very small minority of UNRWA staff members, that just so happened to come out around the same time. Was it the same week as the ICJ?
The
interim measures that were issued by the ICJ, and within a matter of days, then suddenly they're saying that the biggest humanitarian relief agency operating within Gaza was itself somehow compromised.
It's a good point. Yeah, in terms of the strike that happened this week on those aid workers, the fact that these are citizens of the US, the UK, Australia, all countries which have backed Israel to the hilt throughout this. Now you're seeing the White House comes out and says, we're outraged by this. The Australian Prime Minister comes out and says, we're outraged by this. Rishi Sunak says, well, absolutely, let Israel conduct its own investigation into this. But once again, all these Western leaders have come out and said this and have changed nothing in their approach. Joe Biden has come out, and again, you're seeing, you know, US news coverage saying he's toughened his words on Israel. He's shown once again that he's very, very annoyed with what's happening. His frustration with Benjamin Netanyahu. He doesn't have any faith in how Netanyahu is conducting the war. He believes more aid should go in. He believes there's too many civilians being killed. But at the same time, and this is literally happening at the exact same time, that a multi-billion dollar arms deal is going through US Congress, being pushed by the administration, which is urging senators and congressmen to vote for a $15 billion aid package for war planes for Israel at the same time. So I don't understand how you can say as a government and expect people to believe you that you are outraged by these things if you aren't actually doing anything at all.
So just when we look at the situation then on the ground, where are we at? I mean, we know that there are people starving in northern Gaza. We know that people are essentially packed into Rafah. But what is the current state of play for the individuals, for the human beings on the ground there right now?
Well, this is an interesting point, because this is what we're often asked about, is actually what Ireland is doing with regards to all of this. We get emails in about it. We get messages on social media, on Twitter, on Instagram about, well, what's Ireland actually doing while all this is happening? And it brings us to the ICJ case. Remember, the International Court of Justice is hearing that case brought by South Africa, which is accusing Israel of genocide in Gaza. Now, Ireland is intervening in this, which is something we've been talking about in previous weeks, about whether or not Ireland would do this. But Ireland, one of Ireland's main points that it's trying to make in this intervention is to broaden the definition of what genocide is. And effectively, the contention which Ireland is going to make is that there's a collective punishment going on, which is one of the grounds of genocide, by denying ordinary Gazans, ordinary people, access to food, medicine, water, which again is also tied into what we've, you know, the outrage about this attack on the World Central Kitchen workers. Half the population in Gaza is facing famine. 100% of the population of Gaza is facing food insecurity. Now, aid agencies say that only a fifth of the need of aid is actually getting in at this point. Although if you ask some people, it's actually far lower than even that one fifth. So Micheál Martin, who has been, you know, taking the lead on this, as obviously he's the Minister for Foreign Affairs, he says he believes there is a case on this with regards to broadening the definition of genocide. But again, it'll probably even worsen the relations between Ireland and Israel, which are pretty, I mean, they're never particularly rosy. We've been talking about that for a long time, but this is probably going to mark a new low ebb in that.
One thing which I think is striking, just to rewind back a little bit to the consequences of the attack on the World Central Kitchen. It doesn't quite roll off the tongue. You mentioned the nationalities of the people that were involved. You mentioned, you know, the US and the UK and Australia, and the one other nationality that we do know is involved or implicated in this is Poland. Now, that's interesting because that's an EU member. And I remember there was a while we thought the other night that there might have been possibly an Irish citizen involved. It didn't turn out to be the case, but it kind of really had Irish people attuned to what was going on. The fact that an EU citizen has delayed as a result of what appears to be deliberate targeting, or at least whether it was deliberately aimed at or not, was a conscious attack on their convoy, does raise the question of whether there might now be a new push at an EU level. Remember that the Polish Prime Minister now is Donald Tusk, who used to be the chair of the European Council, so he's quite an influential body. So if Poland wanted to try and push forward at an EU level to say, well, now there's a clear breach of the EU-Israel Association Agreement, where you have to have certain human rights compliance, if we now think that that line has been crossed, this Rubicon has been crossed, and maybe you can make that case because EU citizens are now dying as a result of direct Israeli attacks, maybe this is the point at which we might see that button being pressed. There is supposed to be a special meeting of the EU leaders in two or three weeks. It's due to be Simon Harris's first international summit when it gets underway in a couple of weeks' time. But it will be interesting to see whether Poland, particularly because it's Donald Tusk, says, lads, we're getting to a point now where we genuinely, in good conscience, can't allow diplomatic relations to go on as they were anymore. And I'll be really fascinated, specifically because it's Poland, to see whether we go that far. One other thing as well is that hasn't the Spanish Prime Minister announced this week they're going to be recognising Palestinian statehood by June?
I didn't know
June
if they were
July?
Announced. I saw the report that he was considering it anyway.
Yeah, so it now appears to be the case that they will recognise it by July, and they're sort of reserving the right that maybe they might go a little bit earlier. Ireland has been in lockstep with Spain's view on this up until now. So I wonder whether...
Ireland has always been sort of very close to it. Like even when you were on the trip last year, there was kind of thoughts that perhaps it would happen when you were there.
And Leo Varadkar has been more explicit in his language since then that we will recognise a Palestinian state at a time that we think it has maximum, you know, constructive outcomes. So if Spain are now saying, or if they are saying that they will do it by a specific time, I wonder, might one of Leo Varadkar's last acts in office be to set the train in motion to say that I will, you know, chair a cabinet meeting where we'll say, yes, we're going to recognise it by X date as well? Or is this a fracturing of that European front where we've always been in lockstep with Spain up until now, and maybe we might hold off because we don't like the idea of recognising Palestinian statehood while Hamas are still in control? Who knows?
Well, if Leo Varadkar is going to do that, it's going to happen very soon then.
Yeah, because he's going to be out of the job next Tuesday.
By the time we record next week, so... Maybe we might know.
We'll wait and see.
Just a quick one to wrap it up on. I mean, Israel's embassy in Ireland, just in terms of their response to everything and the political discussions that we've seen in recent times, you've seen more and more opposition parties, for example, calling for Ireland effectively to go it alone in terms of sanctions. Now, obviously, we've seen, again, Ireland, Spain amongst the countries which have been pushing for EU level to review the Israel-EU trade association. Israel warning that Ireland would effectively face sanctions itself in terms of if it does go out on a limb and say, well, look, we think that Israel is committing, you know, crimes in Gaza. We think there should be sanctions on it. Israel threatening basically to go mano a mano with Ireland as a result of that. But there's really negative coverage in terms of Israel. I don't know if you've seen this as well. Actually, it's quite obvious, I think, when you look at a lot of the coverage in the Israeli media of things like what's happening around the world. There's a focus on Ireland by the Israeli media that I don't think they'd focus on to the same degree. There's an association they put with us with Palestine, as Ireland is Palestine's number one supporter in the world. And you see Israeli politicians, for example.
See it in the wording of articles. How do you mean?
No, this is true. But there's plenty of examples. So if you go back to, say, the Ireland women's basketball game against Israel.
Oh, yeah.
For example, that was completely misreported in the Israeli media. There was that whole debate about, you know, the coverage of the handshakes of the women's basketball teams before that. There was also the Irish, I think it was the under-15s, women's soccer team played Israel in a friendly. And they did the traditional thing the Irish women's and the Irish men's team do when the national anthem is played. They face the tricolour for the anthem. They do that for every single game. Now, a photo of that was picked up by the Israeli media and got thousands and thousands of retweets. It was published in articles as well, as the Irish women's team turns back on the Israeli flag for anthems. So it was complete bunkum.
No.
Picked up by high profile Israeli politicians. And this has happened multiple times in multiple different ways. And you've also seen it in terms of some of the language directed at Palestinians by right wing politicians in Israel, for example, saying go to Ireland if you want to go to, or go to the desert.
Do you think that's since the whole Leo Varadkar, Emily Hand release debacle that time, or do you think it has predated it
by a long way.
I wonder whether some of it is common language, that because we're a predominantly Anglophile or Anglophone country, rather, definitely not Anglophile, but that because we're an English speaking country, that they sort of have, they feel like our commentary on Middle Eastern stuff is slightly more accessible rather than having it gone through French or German or Italian or Spanish or whatever it else might be.
There definitely is a perception, though,
because of the historical affinity particularly between Irish Republicans and Palestinians, and that idea of unfinished statehood. There is this view in Israel that it's zero sum, that if you're pro-Palestine and pro-Palestinian statehood, that you can't be pro-Israel. And whether that's a justified case or not, I think, is something that people will have to adjudicate for themselves.
Now, April is World Autism Awareness Month, and to mark World Autism Awareness Month, As I Am, the Irish National Charity for Autism has released its annual Same Chance report. In it, it found that 90% of autistic people in Ireland say they do not believe they have the same chance as non-autistic people in Irish society. Gavin, you've written extensively, you've broadcasted extensively on your experiences as a parent in this regard. I'm sure there was little in this that surprised you as such, but it is always
Very, very stark reading.
Yeah, there are some bits which weren't terribly surprising. In fact, there were some bits which were almost surprising. Like, for example, I think there was 74% of people said that being autistic exacerbated the cost of living crisis. I kind of want to meet the other 26% of people and ask how it doesn't. Now, I suppose a lot of those respondents might be adults who might be able to just trundle on by, and they don't believe that their diagnosis or the way in which their brain is wired makes their everyday cost of living any dearer.
It speaks to, I suppose, the broad range on the spectrum, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, this is the point, I suppose, that you know, the month is designated by the UN as being World Autism Awareness Month, but really it ought to be a little broader than that. It ought to be all forms of what we now call neurodiversity, mm-hmm. which is mm-hmm. the great umbrella that includes everything like ADHD or dyslexia or dyscalculia or dyspraxia or any number of other intellectual disabilities that might slightly, you know, impact on the way in which you interact with the general world. But, you know, one thing that really struck me, and the point of these awareness months is not so much to raise awareness for those who already have diagnoses, but rather maybe to illustrate to others the impact that having a diagnosis might have on your everyday life, or the ways in which the world generally just kind of isn't designed to accommodate you. Mm. So, you know, one example that comes up, and I know that there's a few other people with different diagnoses of being neurodiverse that this affects. A few people I know who are like mad film buffs, and who would love the idea of being able to, you know, go to a cinema, and who love nothing more than having the big screen on at home, lights down, popcorn, fully into the whole experience, but don't feel like they can go to a cinema to do it, because the nature of their diagnosis, or the nature of the way in which they interact with the world, means that they are just incapable of sitting still for the full length, particularly now that films are all 2.5-3 hours, like whatever happened to just your hour 30 minute film that you used to have back in the day. They're just incapable of sitting still for that long, or they need to have some other stimulus. So it means that they might want to do what is apparently terrible etiquette and pulling out your second screen and having a glance of your phone or interacting with other things, or just needing to get up and stretch your legs. That kind of a way in which people are literally, some people just are incapable or would be just distressed if they're unable to get up midway through a film. But society is kind of designed where, no, when you go into a movie cinema or you go into a theatre, it's just expected that you sit still and you're quiet and you pay your full attention to what's going on the screen. And that just isn't possible for some people. And I'm not saying that, you know, we're expecting theatres are suddenly to become, you know, lights on, second screen, fire away. Although I did see somebody tweet that on April Fool's Day, that they now just thought that, you know, we've lost the battle against second screens, everyone should just tolerate it. That the pushback was incredible. But actually, I thought it was kind of instructive, because if most people, as this survey finds, want society to be broadly inclusive, well, actually, a fully inclusive society means socially accepting that there are people who can't sit still in a dark environment like that, and who might need a little bit of tolerance or leeway shown to them when it comes to getting up or looking at things or having a better lit environment or walking around. And it's little practical things like that which mean that a lot of people with a diagnosis of being neurodiverse don't feel like they can be regular participants in society. And that's parking all the other employment questions and how they might feel about being in a workplace, you know?
Because that is something that actually came through in the report as well, is that there was people who are non-autistic felt that, that was actually quite a shocking, I actually felt as a finding, that they felt that people, if there was, you know, an outburst of noise or somebody stood up or whatever, that they just think that that person should stay home, which does fall into the bracket of discrimination then in this case.
Yeah, and I know how that feels, because sometimes my child is the one who will stand up at a moment's notice or make that kind of noise. And I get that that's disruptive to other people's expectations of what they would think they'd have in a certain environment. What I suppose the point of the exercise is to illustrate to people and just to have them get to grips with the fact that that is not anyone's attempt to be disruptive. That's not anyone's, you know, demonstration of bad behavior. It's not for the want of parenting or anything else like that. It's just in some people's human natures that they can't help that. And it would just be really helpful for people who are going through that kind of experience for the rest of society to acknowledge that's just the way you are, and we will just accept that that's a part of living in modern day life.
What we're talking about here is empathy. You know, we're talking about empathy. And on this World Autism Awareness Month, what we're talking about is not just being aware of the different experiences of individuals, but actually aware of our own behaviour in that environment and aware of, as you say, how we treat people in that environment. And, you know, Adam Harris-Mazayam was saying yesterday, if you're out and you see somebody and they're maybe, you know, having a moment of overwhelm, or they're, you know, maybe they have a tic or something, or maybe they're quite loud, that actually, instead of being like, you know, oh, will they keep it down, or, you know, or being sort of like impatient and irritated by that, actually to say to yourself, you know, like, no problem. They're obviously having, you know, they have their own thing going on, and to be more empathetic and understanding. And I thought that it was interesting that actually the focus really this month should probably be on all of us asking ourselves, are we, and listen, don't get me wrong, none of us are perfect. And I'm sure we all have moments where something might bother you or annoy you and you've gone out to the cinema for your night or whatever. Yeah. But like the truth is, you know, we don't always check ourselves, I think, as a wider society in terms of how we treat people. It was interesting, I know you and I were chatting about something the other day about going to like a play centre and, you know, not understanding that the juice box belongs to somebody else, for example, you know.
I was in the play centre again this morning. Yeah. No such issues this time. But yeah, when you see a familiar bottle of fruit shoot or something, you go, I'll have that. And you go, no, there's... You need to acknowledge that there's a kind of a social cue there, Darren. Sorry, that's not your one. Yours is over on the other table. Let's go.
But that was such an interesting point, actually, wasn't it? Because it was such a small thing, but actually,
there are some other parents. You could definitely see it in their parents. They kind of understand that, like, sometimes kids just kind of, that any child, whether they're neurotypical or not, would look at that and go, oh, I'll have a bit of that. And so, some parents would sort of go, ah, sure, it's fine. They're all kids. They'll get a bit excited. And you see that sometimes there are other parents who'd like they kind of frown and just go like, could you not have told the child to go to their own table?
Like, as in, like, there's an element then of like, oh, judgment. Oh, like, get your child under control here. Yeah. Like, you know? And it's like, actually.
Yeah. Which is actually a lovely. I hadn't even considered that kind of interaction through this kind of lens. But actually, you're totally right.
Yeah, that's a good example. I think of a public environment.
Some other parents will be very naturally understanding, and they won't even think about whether there's any kind of neurodiversity going on or whether the child might be autistic. They will just go, kids are going to be kids. And there'll be some other people that think, no, sorry, that's my child's bottle. Would you take your hands off it because your hands are sticky from after being in the ball pit or whatever it is?
Yeah.
And that is a really good, useful, thank you for bringing that up, real life example of where people can just be a little more naturally tolerant, where instead of their default position being, why is this other child coming up and putting their sticky hands all over my child's drink
bottle?
Exactly.
And this idea that, like, oh, the parents are so laid back, they just left her wander over here. It's like, well, actually, no, these are parents that have worked really, really hard to try and, you know, you've probably been up all night or you've had a number of challenges before you got to the play centre in the first place.
Sometimes,
And, you know, actually, you're doing the best you can. And this is part of who she is as an individual and to be more open and accepting of that.
One thing you mentioned there in passing is, you know, where the child is kind of like, you know, absconded or sort of gone over without you being able to supervise. And this is the thing, not so much an instance in our household anymore, but there's definitely something associated with autistic or neurodiverse children. Basically, the shorthand way of referring to it is flight risk. That if they see something at the other end of the driveway and they go, oh, I'm interested by that, they're gone.
Off you go.
Sometimes they're just gone. And it's not for the want of having supervision over them, or it's not because you're not chasing them down or whatever. Sometimes they'll just go, I want to have a look at that, and I'm gone. I remember reading another piece about a child whose profile is kind of similar to Darren's, actually, and their parents saying that the child heard the chimes of an ice cream van at the other end of the housing estate where they live and were gone. Because he said, oh, chimes, I like that, I'm gone. Like, didn't matter how many times you would basically try to rugby tackle them on the driveway to be like, no, you're not doing there. Sometimes they're just going, that it's almost like it's a psychological itch that needs scratching, that they almost have no option, like Pied Piper sort of stuff, that they're gone. Yeah. And it's not because they weren't being supervised or because the parent is letting them off on a long leash.
Exactly.
Sometimes it is literally just an impulse that they themselves can't control, let alone anyone else.
One of the things you've been sharing over the last couple of days is actually your wife Kira has written some really, really affecting poems about the experiences of Darren, for example. And I think it's really worth people actually going having a look at them. But one of the things actually you posted yourself was about the fact that you said that families are still having to go to courts to vindicate their rights to assessments, and services are still lagging. Now, obviously, we've talked about this multiple times in the podcast in terms of education. But what else are you talking about there when you talk about families, A, having to go to vindicate their rights to assessments, and then also other services being lagging as well?
Yeah, so the shorthand, without repeating too much, because we talked about it a lot on this episode last year, because I did a radio piece when I was in News Talk. I did a kind of a monologue and that kickstarted the conversation.
Still up there. Still worth watching.
Still there. I'm going to pin it on my Instagram.
The points you made a year ago sadly still stand. Well, Nothing has really changed.
Yeah, all I did this year was just share it. The theme of last year was you should be aware, and all of those things still remain the case. By the way, incidentally, in the meantime, we've had the Minister for Special Education resigning, which means the one person who is supposed to be responsible for making sure that there is adequate provision for children of neurodiversity just isn't there anymore, that brief is not being attended to. But to rewind backwards a little bit, so you are entitled under law to an assessment of need. If a public health nurse or somebody else believes that there might be some neurodiversity going on, or that there might be some degree of an intellectual disability, you're entitled to have that assessment of need conducted within 6 months. And after you get that assessment of need, you're then supposed to get what they call a service statement from the HSE 3 months after that to say, right, here's where we believe you might be neurodiverse or the disabilities you might have. Here are the therapies that we believe that can address that. And here is our program for delivering them to you. Fine in principle. In practice, disaster. Absolutely dreadful, because it now routinely takes 2 to 2.5 years to get the assessment of need done. In the meantime, they've changed, moved some of the goalposts so that, for example, the National Council for Special Education now needs to have an input if your child is of school age. Often they will have nothing meaningful to intervene, but they are required to have some input. And there's all these different bureaucratic bits that all make this melange that takes years and years and years to do. And sometimes people go to court to even just to get that finished. Then the service statement, which is again supposed to be after 3 months, routinely just doesn't come at all. And you people go to court then to be like, well, hang on, where is my service statement? And after that, at least you would think, after the service statement, that there is a program through which the therapies are actually going to be delivered. But it turns out that the private therapies that parents like me are lucky enough to have the means to pay for are not basically delivered in that one-to-one model in the public sector system. So you would think, my child performs really well when they have one-on-one occupational therapy for 45 minutes a week. If that was offered by the public sector, brilliant. But that or speech and language therapy is basically not done one-to-one by the public sector system. So it just isn't done. One other thing, just because I don't want to make this too much of a kind of a monologue, but one other thing, and one of the poems that Kira was working on, Kira Riley Lecturer is her Instagram if you want to go see them, but I'll have them pinned on my
own. Sorry, can I just say, and like I know because you're her husband, but like genuinely coming from me and Richard as well, like we both, you know, like I have to say the poems have been so moving over the last couple of days. Like it's really... I think it's really gives people, like when we talk about understanding and awareness, actually I think reading these poems gives you a proper insight into, and I know you're going to move on to that point, but it's just that idea of not having adequate school places. And when we say adequate, it doesn't always mean that you don't have a place. What it sometimes can mean is that you're going really far away from home when you're already really small and, you know, perhaps, you know, frightened and you know, perhaps, you know, in a strange environment. And it was the poem, the first poem that she posted called Bus. And I just wanted you to read us a tiny bit of the gap, if you wouldn't mind, because I really thought it was just such a gorgeous insight.
Thank you for teaming up to do this, because we didn't explicitly plan this. So this isn't me.
We like improv making podcasts.
We like improv poetry. Yeah. So this is Bus by Kira Riley.
So this is Bus, about our daughter's journey to school. You go in a grey van. We have to send you away from here, you see. This is what we have to do. This is the help. This is a good thing. You are lucky, we hear. We are lucky. You are so small. You go in the dark a lot. I think about this. Headphones, a shield. Your world, a rhythm, only you can hear. This is the only thing you do without me. So I wonder. You have to climb steps, alone ascent. Kind faces surround you. You journey. I do trust. I trust. I have to trust. The day unfurls, a mystery in progress. There is a space. I'm in the space all day long. I am not in the space all day long. I wonder, always wondering, all day. And then you come home again with updates from others. You're back to share. Before you descend, the kind people share. Your day, news, dots are joined. The here to there and back again. We get dispatches from good people who tap, tap, tap into you. You have had a day. Tomorrow, we will send you away again.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Now, we've been very domestic politics heavy on this podcast in recent weeks, so get set for next week when Simon Harris actually becomes Taoiseach.
Yes.
After four weeks of talking. But Fine Gael, it's internal politics, it's wrangling, it's who's getting what seat, what priorities for the new incoming dear leader of the party. He has the Ardèche speech this weekend in Galway as well. One person I was talking to this week in pursuit of, you know, the heat check of where Fine Gael is at the moment was Michael Ring. I came across him walking across the plinth in Leinster House, and here's what he had to say about the future of the party.
Look, and I suppose, and it's like the Dublin football team. 2 years ago, everybody was saying Dublin was gone, finished. Now, I know they got beaten on Sunday, but they rebuilt again and they won the All-Ireland last year. So Fine Gael are at the moment now. We have a new leader in Simon Harris, and he's going to put in a new team. Now, we need to go back into law and order. We need employment, farming, and we need just, you know, the issues that concern people on the ground. The bread and butter issues. Forget about these social issues that we had for the last few years. People don't want these issues. They're running annoying them.
Sorry, is he comparing Fine Gael to the Dublin football team?
I love that a Mayo TD is still so obsessed with the Dublin footballers that even a couple of years after their last encounter in an All-Ireland final, that's still the analogy he's reaching for.
Oh dear.
But the point he's making about particularly that couplet of law and order, SVU, that is something which every Fine Gael TD and senator is banging on about. And I don't know.
Do they even know what that means? It's like Brexit means Brexit. Like, what is law and order? Like, when they say law and order, like, I understand that the premise is that people want to feel safe walking the streets and we need more guards and all that. But, like, what is the crux of, like, what would be a sign of achievement for Simon Harris if he were to, you know, tick that law and order box for Fine Gaelers, for grassroots Fine
Gaelers? Great question, actually. I don't have an easy answer to that.
I don't have the answer either. I do not know.
My answer is a question, and it is the fact that so many people in Fine Gael are, and they will not stick their heads above the parapet to say it. They've been very critical of Helen McEntee and how she's handled, quote unquote, law and order as the Justice Minister. Now, there have been things which have been across politics. She's been criticised for the handling of the Dublin riots, for example, lawlessness in Dublin City, as it's perceived by some people in politics as well. But at the same time, and she'll, as her own defendant, would say that she has advanced issues around domestic violence in particular, more so than any other justice minister has done for a long, long time in this country. But why would Simon Harris be more law and order, or why would somebody else be more law and order than Helen McEntee? Is the question I put to them, and they never really have an answer.
No one even knows what it means. Yeah. Like, what does it mean to be more law and order?
It's interesting that if people want Simon Harris to be a total pivot away from the justice agenda of Helen McEntee,
Who covered injustice when woman was on maternity leave,
by the way. Well, not only that, but while he was covering for Helen McEntee, while she was on that maternity leave, he brought the apparently now quite contentious legislation against incitement to hatred through the Oireachtas Justice Committee. So he was actually responsible for progressing it, and the idea that he might now be asked to jettison that or to stand it down because it's not sufficiently law and order enough would be an interesting one. And actually, if he does decide to park that for 12 months, it'll be very interesting that he's basically like impugning something that he himself progressed quite a bit aggressively while Helen McEntee.
Are you going to Ardèche this weekend?
I don't know. We didn't actually discuss that. I'm working this weekend. I don't know.
Whichever one of you is going.
One of you come back
and tell us next week what they mean by law and order. Can we get a definite?
Yeah, we'll do it. Whichever one of us is going, we'll do a box pop. What is law and order?
I want Fine Gael to tell us, what does achievement look like?
Yeah.
What is it that they want Simon Harris to achieve in terms of law and order in the next 9-10 months, whatever?
Well, if one of the things is
tougher sentences is one thing they will say that.
Okay.
They won't have a very specific answer of how tough these sentences should be, and
for what crimes do you want tougher sentences? But also, you need to make it easier to prosecute some of those crimes, which is at least the stated intent of that legislation around hate speech, the prohibition of incitement to hatred bill. Mm. And one of the reasons why Helen McEntee says that is indispensable is because she says that the DPP's view is that trying to prosecute people for inciting, for example, suspected arson attacks on housing for IP applicants, is too difficult. The threshold is too high, that you need to have a more explicitly stated crime of incitement to hatred against immigrants. And that is one of the things then that will make it easier to prosecute those who inspire arson attacks, not necessarily those who are holding the match. But if you end up jettisoning that bill, one of the law and order things that you are consciously letting down by that logic is prosecuting people for setting fire to community halls and to derelict hotels and nursing homes. So like one person's law is another person's order, you know?
Can I just get back to the kind of the choreography of the next kind of week? Because I suppose people will be wondering, like, what's Coronation Day going to look like on Tuesday? I'll use that term loosely.
Coronation. I think other people will be using it slightly less ironically.
No, I know, it's fine. Yeah.
So it's at some, we think at some point on Tuesday morning, Leo Varadkar is going to make his visit down to the Oras and to basically formally hand in his resignation. The Dáil is due to sit again at 2 o'clock on Tuesday afternoon. Leo Varadkar will stand up and say, for the information of the House, by the way, just resigned. And the County Coroner will go, whoa, didn't see that coming. Guess we better elect a new Taoiseach then. And they'll take nominees and the opposition TDs will all stand up and say, actually, shouldn't have a nominee, should have a general election. Someone from the coalition, probably Leo Varadkar himself, will stand up and say, I think Simon Harris should be Taoiseach. The 80 coalition TDs plus Joe McHugh plus Mark McSharry plus maybe one or two others will say, I agree, we shouldn't have an election. We should let Simon Harris be Taoiseach to do his thing. And he goes and gets appointed and then appoints his new cabinet that night. A cabinet which we now obviously, which won't include Simon Coveney.
So that brings us nicely on to the Simon Coveney news, which before we start on the Simon Coveney news, Simon Coveney says he's not going to be, he doesn't want to be a minister, right? Did he leave before he didn't get a gig or did he leave because he's genuinely over it? But also why, if he's leaving, why didn't he just say, I'm not running in the next election? Like what, why is there like...
It's not amazing that, is it?
Like, I mean, what
to
are
be,
you doing?
To be a matter of days ago saying... I am standing in the next election.
Yeah, and he was saying, very explicit when he was asked that, wasn't he?
Yeah, and it was little over a week ago, wasn't it?
But then that implies really that if you still want to stay in politics, why would you not want to stay at a high level? I know it's a high level. Look, we can talk about all the reasons why it's high pressure and high level and everything. We can talk about all of that. But like, is it your perception that Simon Harris is aiming towards a fresher look Fine Gael cabinet?
I think he has a lot of... There's this thing, and I find it almost... It's a weird nuance of Irish politics that when you look at... if you read any of the coverage today about what Simon Harris needs to do in terms of his picking his cabinet, it's not about policy. It's about where on the map people should be from.
No. Yeah. And does that matter anymore? Like it used to matter. There was a time when it really mattered.
It does to the party.
Like, you know, as somebody who's from Waterford, for example, you know, when we had a minister for a while, everyone thought it was great, and then they haven't had one for ages now. Mm. And it's, you know, there was a time where people thought that having a minister in your parish mattered.
Yeah, and seems to be this big concern that Fine Gael might not have a minister from Cork anymore, which is kind of mad because there are still two other significant cabinet ministers from the same constituency. The Taoiseach and the Minister for Finance are from the same constituency as Simon Coveney. But because they're not from Fine Gael, apparently that's a big issue for Fine Gael. And they would need to have at least one Cork minister going into the next election, they say. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm lucky enough to be from the Pale, so the geography of ministers has never kind of mattered as much in my patch as it might do in others. But I get that for some people, it's a huge sensitivity. And remember, there was a time where Ireland wasn't going to have a European commissioner for a while. They were trying to rationalise. Mm. And we caused the whole European thing to come unstuck because we insisted on having a commissioner. So I know it's a big thing. But when you only have six cabinet seats to go around, which is all that Simon Harris has, and he's one of them, it's a really difficult balance to have. If you want to have a bit of a balance of gender and of geographical spread, like it's a very difficult thing to do when you've only got six bodies.
No, and in fairness, almost the most revolutionary thing he could possibly do is actually just pick people based on how their aptitude for the job and how he thinks, how well he thinks they do their job, which should almost be a mature way of doing politics. Not to say, like, obviously there's considerations there and you should, I mean, most political parties now at this point in time say they should have a balance between, you know, male and female ministers in terms of, you know, having a gender balance around the cabinet table. There has been an exodus from Fine Gael. I don't know how Simon Harris is addressing that. We have, you know, some open questions as some people will turn around. And we've heard all of the talk, including on this podcast, about TikTok, Taoiseach and all that sort of stuff.
You can't use that again this week.
No. So annoying.
I keep saying that. I still think Taoiseach is better.
No.
Anyway, sorry.
The fact of the matter is, there's all this talk about who's going to be sitting where around the table, you know, what personalities, who's winning, who's losing and all that sort of stuff.
Has he managed to convince anyone to stay?
It doesn't matter. The point is, what does Simon Harris actually have to do to win people over? There's no talk about policy in any of this stuff apart from the law and order stuff, which we've talked about how, you know, wishy-washy that actually is.
Or the use of TikTok, which apparently is what's intended to win people over, no matter what you're selling.
I think what Simon Harris needs to do this weekend is actually spell out what his leadership is actually going to mean in a different sense. Because people are able to now, and Sinn Féin have been doing it very vocally and repetitively over the last couple of days, is pointing out the fact of what he's not said. He's not said anything about housing and homelessness. Mm. Simon Coveney is walking away, having been previously the housing minister, and saying that it would be, you know, he'd end the use of hotels, for example, in use of homeless accommodation. Mm. We're now several years on from that point, and we've seen the record reach higher and higher and higher. So this government needs to start talking about housing and homelessness again, even if
Simon Harris has been slow to get to grips with that issue since being appointed party leader.
So the Stardust Inquest, you guys might remember, it's been on for nearly a year now. It started in April of last year. We're obviously into April now. Finally, today, as we record, it's now 3 o'clock on Wednesday afternoon. The deliberations are underway. So the jury's been sent home for the day. They're coming back tomorrow to really get stuck into their deliberations. It's interesting, like when you ask how long do you think it's going to take, you know, they have listened to just under 200 witnesses and sat for more than 100 days of hearing. So you'd imagine there'd be quite a lot to go down through. But, you know, the coroner's summing up was quite extensive as well, and it's probably refreshed their memory in a lot of ways in terms of the evidence they heard. So they heard from people in relation to the sort of the days leading up to the Stardust fire, people who were there on the night, neighbours who lived close by, survivors, obviously, expert witnesses, and they've had a lot of detail to sort of recount and process. So the coroner has given them 5 potential verdicts that they can take into consideration. So they include accidental death, death by misadventure, unlawful killing, an open verdict and a narrative verdict. So 5 different possibilities. She's also given them 48 questionnaires. So 48 individual questionnaires for every single person who died in the Stardust fire. And within that, then they'll fill out identifying the individual, when they died, cause of death and all that kind of thing. So it's interesting that I suppose every single person will have their own individual decision made as well. So given the fact that there's so much to get through, you would have thought it might take quite a while. There are other people who are speculating that perhaps the verdict might be back a little bit sooner. Perhaps it might even be back by the time we record at this time next week. But I suppose crucially for the families, you know, this was 43 years ago. And I think for the families at the centre of this, they're just really hopeful of getting some kind of clarity. They've been waiting for some sort of an answer for a really long time. And the coroner is clear that this is a fact-finding mission. So we'll wait and see what happens.
We'll wait and see. We'll bring you all of the details on it when it does actually, when they do come back. But to finish off this week, a story which we were talking about in the actual WhatsApp, the group chat yesterday. A story that caught my eye in the Sunday Times last weekend, report by John Mooney and Beau Donnelly. It was also a co-production with Bellingcat, the investigative journalist website. It's about the online and travel habits of one Christy Kinahan Sr., the Dapper Don, one of the world's most wanted men. There's a $5 million bounty, of course, put on his head courtesy of the US government.
Going by a different alias this weather?
Christopher Vincent, which is apparently, it's his first and middle name. So that's, he's using it as now a first and a surname, his first and middle name. But effectively, he's become quite the reviewer of places like restaurants and establishments around the world on Google Maps. So it's a fascinating insight into the movements of the world, one of the world's most wanted men. Yeah. Clearly, he's left a very significant digital footprint behind him.
This is demented that this has happened.
So he boasts of international trips to the likes of Spain, Hungary, Turkey, the Netherlands, Hong Kong, Egypt, Zimbabwe and South Africa, as well as, of course, establishments in Dubai, where the Kinahan family effectively does reside at this point in time. For example, one of the reviews he left is kind of short and sweet, a restaurant in Istanbul in August of 2022, which he described as chic and plush. The service was good, but not outstanding. Some comments detail attending business networking conferences in Zimbabwe and of watching a sunset with colleagues in South Africa as they discussed some business. Bellingcat, which is that website, does a lot of work actually on Russia.
They've actually done some work on the strike on the aid convoy as well that we're talking about in part one.
Yeah, it's a great website. If you've never heard it or heard of it or seen it, it's worth having a look at it. But they worked with the Sunday Times to confirm the profile was his, given it was the use of one of his email addresses and a physical address, which was in the US sanctions documents. Also, his reflection appears in some of the windows or mirrors.
So he's taken like food photos.
Because if you ever put up a review on Google Maps,
they ask you for a photograph. Yeah.
And
his reflection appears in some of them. Like, It blows
unbelievably stupid.
It blows my mind that, you know, I don't know whether it was within the lifetime of the podcast. Remember, Richard, you were there in City Hall on the day that they announced this coordination with the guards and the FBI. They're saying like a $5 million reward for information that leads to the whereabouts of
each of them,
of each of the three senior figures. And he's one of them. So he knows that there is literally a $5 million bounty on his head. And he is, in a fairly covert, really unguarded way, just telling everyone where he's been. Like, are any of his Google results or Google reviews been, I enjoyed this, we'll go again in future, thanks everyone, see you soon? Like, is he advertising where people can claim their bounty again?
I just can't
some
believe
other time?
That there's been such an international, you know, he's a wanted man and he's probably going to get tracked down for being a low-level food influencer. Like, it seems insane to me.
It's an interest. It's so interesting. It does provide, as the website say, valuable clues to his lifestyle and movements. We'll leave you all with one review for the Cycle Bistro in Dubai. Service was good and the staff were pleasant and helpful. The menu caters for non-vegan dairy and sugar. I had the acai bowl. Isn't it acai bowl? Followed by eggs with almond bread and green salad. My meal was well presented and tasty. I give this establishment, he says, 5 stars. So he's posted over 1,000.
He's a low-level food influencer. Yeah. It's amazing.
It's staggering stuff. And it is just like you think that in this day and age, you'd be conscious of what you post online, particularly if you're a very wanted man. But he apparently has posted over more than 1,000 photos to this over the course of a number of years. So
we can see if any of them now actually kick off. Then now that international attention has been brought to how good his reviews are for these bistros, will they now have people queuing out the door? Well, Christopher Vincent said it was great. Looking forward to this now.
So that's pretty much the lot for this week. We have a lot of things probably to come in next week, obviously.
There'll be a new cabinet.
New cabinet. Yeah.
Mm. We finally found the time to listen to Beyonce's new album by then, because I hear it's an epic.
Pretty long. Too long, some would say.
Too long.
We will listen to it for next week, though.
I wanted to
kind of have time to listen to it. I need a long drive to get really stuck into it, I think. Yeah.
23 tracks, is it?
An hour and 18 minutes. I'm
save your thoughts for next week, your knowledge.
Yeah, I just said, well, that's the only thought I'll give you now at this point, is it's probably too long. It's great, right, but too long.
You expect me to find an hour and 18 minutes in WrestleMania weekend to listen to a Beyonce album? That's a stretch. Yeah, but I'll do it for you guys.
Squeeze it in. Yeah. Listen to it in portions. That's all we have time for this time on the group chat, though. Sarah and Gavin, thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard. Very much.
Very much indeed. We'll see you this time next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.